now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpit. Here's Nick Perez.
Yes, and how's it? And welcome to Live from the Pulpit, the cutting edge in biblical exposition, coming to you on location in Merced, California, home of the Merced Church of Christ. This is the fastest half-hour podcast in the West, where I, your humble correspondent, the voice of the valley, Nick Perez, offer up news and views you can use on Scripture and society with a little help from my friends. Greetings and welcome to the program. Glad you tuned in. I want to wrap up a study that I began in the previous episode. Is there a God? That's our question of the day today. Is there a God? Does God exist? We're presenting proofs for the existence of God. And as I mentioned in the previous episode, the nature of proof and evidence, proof is merely the amount of evidence necessary to convict or convince. And for some, you may not need as much evidence as others. And that's okay. But certainly with the superabundance of evidence that is available concerning the existence of God, that at least one of these arguments, and they're classical arguments, one of these arguments would stick with you and would move you toward belief in a God, and we can move forward from there as to what kind of a God is he. We'll do that in a future episode. But again, I've presented already a number of arguments. Go back and listen to the previous episode, Is There a God, Part 1, and you can get caught up with what has already been presented. Now, let me move on to an argument that I left off with yesterday, simply because it is such an important and also one that is often taken for granted. And that's this argument for the fact that God is an innate idea. I mentioned an article put out by Reason and Revelation, which is an apologetics press outfit, their magazine. And they had an article entitled, Why is Belief in God Natural to Mankind? Studies have been done by folks in the realm of psychology and things like that, demonstrating that children are, quote, intuitive theists. It's built into them to believe in God. Well, at the end of this article, I want to quote part of it, because as the argument goes, all normal human beings are born with the idea of God implanted in the mind, though it can be suppressed in unrighteousness. The Apostle Paul talks about that in Romans 1, verses 18 and 19. You can suppress that knowledge of God in unrighteousness. You can wall off the truth. But they come to the end of this article here, and again, one of the points of this argument is that children grow up, the idea of God becomes clearer, and experiences in the course of life cause that idea to come alive. And so at the end of this article, notice the admission by these atheistic writers. They are forced by the evidence to admit that humans are naturally inclined to believe in an intelligent designer. They are further forced by the evidence to conclude that the various tenets of atheistic evolution are counterintuitive and unnatural. Yet, in spite of the evidence, they cling to the idea that somehow this situation can be reconciled with the belief that God does not exist. Notice that a presumption of atheism could never have predicted the situation that humans would be intuitive theists, nor do the purported atheistic answers to the problem provide adequate explanatory value. The simple and most powerfully supported conclusion is that God exists, and that is why humans are innately predisposed to be creationists. This is something you know. You want to talk about things we know. You know innately, intuitively, that there is a God. It's born into you. Jay Bujajewski talks about how in order to get away from that, you have to remove the hard drive itself. You can pull out individual parts, but short of pulling out the hard drive, you could never fully erase or efface that knowledge. The ancients talked about, John Calvin, he talked about the sensus divinitatis, that divine sense. We have these antenna that are up and they are attuned to the spiritual. And so you know this, my friend. You know intuitively that God exists. There's an argument that is related to this. Yeah. The argument from blessedness. This is something put forward by Augustine, Thomas Aquinas. I've referenced several of his arguments yesterday. He sort of built upon this. But it's the argument that humans are restless with a vague longing for blessedness until they rest in God. That's what Augustine said. What he wrote one time was that our souls are restless until they find rest in thee, talking about God. Well, this longing, as the argument goes, is given by God. As Scripture says, and he's Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart. It's there. It's built in. There's the innate argument. And so the presence of this longing, it's an indirect proof of God's existence. That's the argument from blessedness. This longing built into us for blessedness. All right, let me get to a really big one here. It's what's known as the anthropological argument, or the moral argument. Sometimes that's how it's known. Guys like C.S. Lewis, Immanuel Kant, they're the ones who put forward this argument for God. And it goes something like this. All human beings possess a moral impulse or categorical moral imperative. Since this morality is not always rewarded in this life, there must be some basis or reason for moral behavior that is beyond this life. This implies the existence of more immortality, ultimate judgment, and a God who establishes and supports morality by rewarding good and punishing evil. Now, again, this is one of the things that you cannot not know. Jay Bujarzewski, he's written that book, What We Can't Not Know. One of the things we cannot not know is that there is a natural law. Bujarzewski ties it directly to the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue. I've argued in my thesis that ultimate punishment is something that we cannot not know. If there is a moral, this natural moral law, this common sense morality, then it stands to reason that just like in the natural world, in culture and society, when you break civil laws, punishment follows that, whether you pay a fine or you do jail time, just depending upon the degree and the severity of the crime committed. You commit the crime, you must do the time. Well, what if the crime is never punished in this life? Surely there must be something, an expectation of, well, as it's talked about here in the anthropological argument, there must be punishment, ultimate judgment, final justice. And since nature abhors a vacuum, Darwinian evolution would necessarily say, yeah, there cannot be an unfulfilled desire. So there you have it. There is this justice, this punishment that we cannot not know. And there is reward, blessedness, in the afterlife for a life well-pleasing to the deity. Now, there are some who would argue against this argument. They might say that the moral impulse of human beings can be attributed to sources other than God, like the idea of conscience developing as a necessary part of the evolutionary process or natural selection, something like that. But the thing about the conscience or moral impulse of human beings is not in their best interest in terms of survival most times. It is unlikely that since that's the case, that the conscience would develop as a necessary part of natural selection. Doesn't make sense that they would do things that are contrary to survival of the fittest. Well, they might argue back, well, if God exists as a rewarder of good, why does evil exist? Especially if, as we theists would propose, God is all good and he's all powerful. Well, if he's all good, but evil still exists, then he must not be powerful enough to stop it. Or he's all powerful, but evil exists, then he's not all good. That's sort of how they would reason that out. But here's the thing. Though the existence of a God who is good and all powerful may mandate the destruction of evil, it does not necessarily mandate that destruction now. In other words, he will ultimately right all wrongs in the end. He doesn't have to do it right this instant, right now. And in fact, evil in the world only strengthens the moral argument. You see, if evil exists, and you would be hard-pressed to find anybody who says, no, evil doesn't exist, people know there are certain things which are always wrong, like rape and child abuse and things like that. That's always wrong, regardless of time and space. Those are transcendent, therefore. Well, if evil exists, there must be the contrast to that, which is good. If such a thing as evil exists, such a thing as good must also exist. If good and evil exist, there must be such a thing as a moral law by which we are able to differentiate between good and evil. And that moral law is transcendent because there are certain things which are always right and certain things which are always wrong, regardless of time, space, culture, etc. If there is this transcendent moral law, there must be this transcendent moral law giver who has given us the moral law by which we can differentiate between good and evil. We call that great moral law giver God. Hat tip Ravi Zacharias for that little tidbit. Yes, certain things. And this is something you know. Something which is common knowledge. It's common sense that there are certain things which are right and certain things which are wrong, and they are always right and they are always wrong. What the Nazis did during World War II. Genocide, mass genocide. Millions of people murdered systematically. Executed systematically. And then what the Soviet government did, the atheistic Soviet government, what the communist Chinese government does, I mean, those things are wrong. And in fact, when we put some of the Nazis that we captured in World War II on trial, we so they not only committed crimes against humanity, but they violated a law which transcends the transient, which means it transcends the here and the now. It violates even touching to the spiritual. And so, yes, that's, again, it's something that we know. And so God, he makes sense. Let me put it this way. God makes sense of objective moral values in the world. Rape is always wrong. Only God makes sense of that. You take God out of the picture, it doesn't make sense. Then it is a survival of the fittest type thing. And if I want it, I'm going to take it. See, that's the thing. If God does not exist, then these objective moral values do not exist. Objective in the sense that they are valid and they are binding. But objective moral values do exist, and therefore God exists. Without God, there is no absolute right. There is no absolute wrong that imposes itself on our conscience. But deep down we know. We know that objective values do exist. There are these moral evils and there are these moral goods like love and self-sacrifice. And so God's nature, which is good, is an appropriate starting point and stopping point for the standard of goodness. Another way to get there, and I just referenced it a moment ago, if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. Well, evil exists, and therefore objective moral values exist. Therefore, good exists. Therefore God exists, I should say. Because again, there are some things which are truly evil. Okay, so that's the anthropological argument, the argument from morality. It's something that you know. There's some others. I'm going to just throw them out there just so you're aware of them, and perhaps if the other arguments haven't worked thus far, maybe these will sink deeply into your ears and into your mind. A lady by the name of Evelyn Underhill, she put forward an argument from mysticism. It goes something like this. Mankind is able to have a direct mystical experience with God, resulting in an ecstatic experience. This union with God is so uniquely overpowering that it self-validates the existence of God. You see what she's saying there? In other words, because we are able to have these mystic, and she was a mystic. What's the other guy's name? Tozer, A.W. Tozer. He was another mystical guy. He might buy into this argument for mysticism, that you're able to have these existential-type experiences, these mystical experiences with God, and those experiences are self-validating for the existence. In other words, it's self-evident that God exists. That's another one. Let me get another one here. How about right along with that is the existential argument. It's slightly different. It goes something like this. God proves himself via the kerygma. The kerygma, by the way, that's your word for proclamation, like of the gospel in the New Testament. That's your Greek word for it. So God proves himself via the kerygma, which is his declaration of love, forgiveness, and justification of mankind. Those who decide for the kerygma then know that God exists. No other evidence is needed. God is not so much proven as he is known. And that occurs existentially from experiences in life. Again, that goes kind of hand in hand with that mystical, that argument from mysticism, mystical experience, existential type experience. Because you have these experiences of maybe the senses could be, but maybe beyond that, some kind of spiritual experience, well, these kind of become self-validating. You don't need any other evidence for this. Is all you need is deciding for the kerygma or having some kind of experience. So it sort of leans toward the Gnostic idea. I'm not real keen on it, but they're there. They're there. There's also the argument of perception. A guy by the name of George Berkeley, he's a bishop. He came up with this argument from perception. It goes something like this. Human beings are able to perceive things. You have senses, hearing and sight and smell and taste and touch. Well, this cannot be caused either by physical events or by human beings themselves. Therefore, the existence of perception implies God's existence as the only rational explanation for human perceptions. In other words, because perception takes place in the mind, it's a mental act. Physical events, physical circumstances, processes aren't able to get you there. So God's existence, that's the only rational explanation for human perceptions. I know I did the ontological argument in the previous episode. Major premise, minor premise, conclusion goes like this. Mankind has an idea of an infinite and perfect being. Existence is a necessary part of perfection. an infinite and perfect being exists, since the very concept of perfection requires existence. Now, to go along with that idea, at least of the infinite being, you have this argument from mankind's finitude. Humans are aware of their finitude. We are finite beings, in other words. We are not infinite, at least in and of ourselves. What makes us aware of our finitude is that God is continually impressing humans with His infinity, His infinitude. Therefore, the sense of finitude itself is proof that an infinite being, God, exists. This goes back a long ways. You ever hear of a guy named Aristotle? Aristotelian philosophy? Yeah, humans, we're aware that we're finite beings. We're aware of this because God keeps showing us how infinite He is. And so that sense of our transient being is proof that a finite being exists. That's God. Here's another one put forward by one of the early church writers, Augustine. It's the argument from truth. It goes something like this. All people believe that something is true. All right? Everyone believes something is true. Well, if God is the God of truth and He's the true God, then God is truth, capital T. This capital T truth is the context for all other truth, lowercase t. Therefore, the existence of lowercase t truth implies the existence of capital T truth, which implies the existence of God. In other words, you know, because it is true that I am married to my wife. Well, the basis for that little t truth is the capital T truth of God. Or the capital T truth of Jesus, who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. All the facts that we may have in this world are ultimately dependent upon the truth, capital T. That's Jesus, that's God. Again, I've gone through about, 15 different arguments? I'm sure there are more, but these are just what I have in front of me. Arguments for the existence of God. Sort of the big four are the ontological, cosmological, theological, and anthropological arguments. And I've gone through all those in the past two episodes. You know, the thing is, when it comes, again, that God exists is something that you know innately. It's intuitive. It goes back to what Paul says over in Romans 1, where he talks about how what can be known about God, verse 19, is plain to them, plain to everyone, because God has shown it to them. For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. You can suppress that truth in unrighteousness, but it never goes away. It's always there. Now I'll wrap up this study in a moment. First, let me get to our sponsor for this half hour. This half hour brought to you by Merced Church of Christ, located at 2050 Yosemite Parkway. The Merced Church of Christ is composed of people devoted to the Word of God, people devoted to the worship of God, and people devoted to the work of God. Our purpose is to see as many people as possible following Jesus as closely as possible, all toward a more united fellowship. The Merced Church of Christ meets every Lord's Day, that's Sunday, for Bible study at 9:30 a.m., morning worship at 10:30 a.m., and evening worship at 6 p.m. We also meet for midweek Bible study every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. She's served by her preaching minister, yours truly, Nick Perez. Go online and visit www.mercedchurchofchrist.org. Merced Church of Christ, making and maturing disciples. Is there a God? Does God exist? I have given what I am persuaded is sufficient proofs to answer in the affirmative. Yes, God exists. He makes sense of the origin of the universe. That's connected to the cosmological argument. It's connected to the teleological argument. But he makes sense of the origin of the universe. When you see complex design, it demands a designer. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Even atheists admit this. Everybody admits whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. And so therefore the universe has a cause. And as I've mentioned before, that cause, since there is no infinite regression, he himself must be uncaused, the great uncaused cause. He himself must be eternal or timeless, standing outside of time. And he also must be changeless, unaltered by time, because he himself created time. And he must be a spiritual, an immaterial being transcending time and space. Again, no infinite regression, because to try and subtract an infinite from an infinite, you still have infinity. God makes sense of the universe. God makes sense of the complex order of the universe. Again, this is tied directly to the teleological argument. That according to scientists, life and even our existence, it's balanced on a knife's edge. We're talking about very precise creation here. Life, our existence, depends on finely tuned initial conditions at the very start, as well as even now, it requires finely tuned conditions. These conditions are so finely tuned to a degree that it is both incalculable and incomprehensible. Now, you only have three choices when it comes to this high degree of complexity. Natural law did it, chance did it, or maybe just maybe it was designed. Natural law would say something like a life permitting universe needs strong proof, but there is none for natural law to take this. Chance, well, again, the odds are just too great. Incalculable. It's equivalent to a chimp sitting at a typewriter producing a Shakespearean sonnet. It's just not going to work. But maybe, just maybe, the fine-tuning of the universe is due to design. Again, there are only three options: natural law, chance, and design. And if it's not due to natural law and chance, then it must be due to design. Someone might say, well, explain the designer. Well, for one, just in a simply straightforward apologetic, our explanation of design does not require an explanation of the designer. We can do that, and we will, but it doesn't require an explanation. It just says there is a grand designer. Someone might say, well, it's a bad design. But the design hypothesis says nothing to the moral qualities of the designer. We can get to that another time. I'm out of time, actually. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. Always like to hear what you have to say. Search Facebook, Life from the Pulpit. Like the Facebook page. You get all the updates when I go live with the podcast, update the blog, or post a new video on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube, Life from the Pulpit. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. You have several Question of the Day segments there. Follow me on Twitter, @inpulpit, at the letter N is a Nick Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. Be sure to stop at the Life from the Pulpit blog, lifefromthepulpit.wordpress.com. All my commentary there on Luke, James, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, as well as Philippians, all there, all available, all free for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Now on iTunes, search the iTunes store, Life from the Pulpit, and download all the episodes to your particular iDevice. You'll never be more than a click away from an episode of the podcast. Check out Mercy Church of Christ website, mercychurchofchrist.org, mercychurchofchrist.org. Plenty of sermon, audio, and resources to help you in your daily walk with the Lord as well. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.